Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Amy Santee. I'm with the George Kaiser Family Foundation, and I am very excited to be here along with Judge Jesse Harris to discuss criminal justice. My role at the foundation is a program officer. So unlike the judge, I am, although a member of the bar, I am not a practicing attorney. My interest in policy work is around the foundation's interest in ensuring that all children in our community have an opportunity to succeed and be successful. So in 2009, the George Kaiser Family Foundation began investigating the issue of female incarceration. It was a problem in our community, and it had been for a very long time, but what aligns so nicely with the foundation's mission is that what we learned through our study of female incarceration and the impact of children was that we recognized that this practice and policy in our state was having devastating impact on children. And so we felt compelled to act, compelled to understand the issue, and really become involved. So most of our activities at the foundation surround the well-being of families, strengthening family mother-daughter relationships. So when we learned that Oklahoma leads the nation in its rate of female incarceration and at twice the national average, we wanted to really understand what was going on in our community, in our state, to cause a graph to look like this. So the bottom row is the national average for the rate of female incarceration. The top is Oklahoma's rate. You can see in almost any given year, in 18 of the past 19 years, Oklahoma has been number one. We are currently twice the national average. So what this number means is that nationally, the average is 63 women go to prison per 100,000. In Oklahoma, it's 127 women per 100,000. If you look at our surrounding states, you look at Texas, for example, even their incarceration rate is significantly lower than Oklahoma's. So it's not a regional issue. It's not that all states around Oklahoma are incarcerating at high rates. It is really unique to Oklahoma. So a Texas is 88 per 100,000, and Kansas, 46 per 100,000. When you look at the type of charges, what we see is that the majority are drug or drug-related. The majority of female offenders are nonviolent offenders. So if you look at last fiscal year's receptions, so the women who were sent to prison in Oklahoma, 75% entered on a nonviolent charge, and 78% were assessed by Department of Corrections as being a minimal risk to public safety. So what we are doing is incarcerating nonviolent female offenders. When you start to research a woman's pathway into the criminal justice system, what you learn is oftentimes that pathway begins very early in life. They are involved in chaotic home environments. They're in abusive homes. They have low educational attainment, oftentimes living in poverty. By the time they present at the Department of Corrections, this is what we know about our female offenders in Oklahoma. This information comes from surveys conducted by Dr. Susan Sharp at the University of Oklahoma. This survey was taken in 2010. In about another month, we are going to have new information, but I suspect that it will look very similar to this. And what we know about women in prison, when they were children, 2 out of 3 were abused physically or sexually as children. That trauma oftentimes went untreated. 50% ran away from home, and 61% came from single-parent divorced or divorced homes. In adulthood, the violence repeats. As adults, 70% end up in domestic violence relationships, and 36%, and this is all self-reported, are victims of rape. thinking again about those pathways into the criminal justice system, 61% are being assessed when they are entering the Department of Corrections with a moderate or high need for substance abuse treatment. I am confident that this number is underreported, because when they are getting assessed for this need, they are in prison. There is an officer asking them questions like this. Did you have drugs in the home when you were arrested? How often did you smoke pot? Were kids around when you were doing drugs? And so there are a lot of women who would be scared under that circumstance, to be honest. Even under those circumstances, 61% have a high or moderate need for substance abuse. 95% were unemployed at the time they were arrested. 63% were relying on some form of social assistance. 75% had a need for basic education. And 79% had a current or previous need for mental health services. But this is where the rubber hits the road. This is where the real issue is a problem for our state and for our community. Of those mothers who are being sent to prison, there are close to 5,000 children under the age of 18 associated with those women. 5,000 minor children. Again, a self-reported number while they are in prison. So I imagine that number is much higher. Of those, almost 50% were living with their mothers at the time they went to prison. So you have a lot of children who have lost their primary caregiver. Now here's the second layer. This is where we can't seem to break the cycle. What happens to those children? What we know about children of incarcerated parents is that they are more likely to engage in risky behavior. They are more likely to run away from home, drop out of school, get involved in non-healthy relationships. So what does this all sound like? It sounds like the pathways to prison for our female offenders. So the cycle is repeating itself. And what research shows is children with a parent who is incarcerated is more likely to go to prison themselves. So here are our numbers today. Total female population, 2,889. This is the highest number I've seen since we've been tracking it since 2009. Our prison admissions statewide, so prison admissions, I mean, in fiscal year 13, how many women as a state did we send to prison? 1,153. Okay, looking at fiscal year 14 through May, we're up 23%. Our numbers are 1,433. Okay. Tulsa County, last fiscal year, 2013, Tulsa County sent 214 women. Fiscal year 14 through May, 306 women, up 43%. Oklahoma County, also up, not as significantly as Tulsa County. So our prison receptions, the prison admissions, women being sent to prison in our state are still going up. Releases statewide, 1,000 going out, 214 returning to Tulsa County, 194 returning to Oklahoma County. What's interesting about these numbers and what is unique to the female offender population in Oklahoma is almost half the population turns over every year. So you have about anywhere from 1,100, 1,500 women going into the system and 1,500 women going out. With that piece of information, we should, as a state, as a county, be able to get a handle on those numbers. Because if we just slowed down the flow, then our rates would drop because our overall population would drop. Okay? When we're talking about policy and in the criminal justice arena, you want to know what works to reduce recidivism. What is going to prevent the individuals from offending again? And there's been a lot of research in the recent years about how to work with individuals involved in the criminal justice system. And there are three consistent themes. You need to focus on the offenders who are most likely to offend again. You need to invest in programs that work and ensure that they continue to work well. And you need to strengthen supervision and use swift and certain responses. On that third one, what we're trying to do when we are working with offenders is we want to change the way they think. We want to change their criminal thinking into pro-social activities and thinking. And it's hard to change behaviors. I don't know how many of y'all have ever tried a diet or tried to stop smoking or dipping or whatever it may be. Changing behavior is hard. And so what we know in the area of criminal justice is that when someone messes up, you need to respond quickly and swiftly, and it needs to match their offense. So, for example, if a drug addict is trying to recover, has been entangled in the criminal justice system, and slips and has a dirty UA, you don't wait 6 months for that individual, that woman, to test dirty for six straight months before intervening. At that point, you come in, you say you have a dirty UA, you may sanction her quickly to a day or two in jail, and then you let her get back on track and try to continue with her recovery. What we see in a lot of our supervision and services is that it's a one shot and you're out. And if you mess up or if you break this rule, it's not caught for so long that by the time it gets to the court, it looks like this person hasn't been doing anything for years or 6 months. And so the supervision and the swift certain response is definitely something we need to consider. So when you're looking at policy options in the area of criminal justice, you can look at three points in the criminal justice continuum. You can look at the front end. What can we do to slow down receptions? What can we do to hold individuals accountable on the front end, have supervision, and provide the services they need to keep them from returning again? So here are some policy options to consider on the front end. Use a risk assessment, a validated, objective risk assessment, to determine the level of risk of that individual. Is it a low risk that she will offend again? Is she a medium risk or a high risk? What the research says is if you have limited dollars, which we have in our state, you want to focus on those most likely to offend, which are the high risk. But what gets lost in translation oftentimes is that you hear high risk and you think that means they need to go to prison. All that means is that they are high risk and you need to look at their risk and their needs to determine whether that individual can be safely supervised in the community. So I understand on Sunday you met many of the women from Women in Recovery. Those women are high risk women. When they were assessed to admittance into the program, they were all assessed at a high-risk, high-need level. But as we know, after operating this program for 5 years, they can be safely supervised in the community, provided intensive services, and can recover. Okay, so that's the first one. There are currently insufficient resources available to people under community supervision. So there's another disconnect where policy isn't aligning with research. What it says is, yes, these individuals can be safely supervised in the community if they are given the services they need to help them with their addiction or their employment needs or changing the way they think. Swift and certain sanctions we've already talked about. Combining the supervision with treatment. Incentive-based approaches. This is something that I've always been very interested in because as a taxpayer, it bothers me that Tulsa County gets to send so many more women to prison than Oklahoma County, which is 25% bigger. That doesn't make sense to me. And so there needs to be some incentive for counties to do the right thing, to keep individuals in the community, use the funding to provide services and supervision. But right now, Tulsa County, as a county, sends more women, sheer numbers, than any other county in the state. So other states have done there've been an array of incentive-based approaches where, for example, if one particular county is probation office, for example, is high on accelerating individuals to prison who are on probation. There have been states that have said, listen, county, if you reduce that number to where we think it's going to be, we'll give you part of that money we were going to spend incarcerating that person to actually treat the person. And we've seen some great returns in those communities. The second area is around sentence length. What can we do to consider shortening sentences? Because quite honestly, some of our sentencing mandatory minimums are arbitrary. There is nothing to say that someone who's serving 5 years is going to be any better than someone who serves 4 years. So as a state, we have a significant number of mandatory minimums. Sometimes the sentence length does not at all comport with the research around the charges of the individuals and the needs of the individuals. So I think it is extremely important as a state we begin reviewing our mandatory sentencing laws and really taking a look at how we are treating those nonviolent drug offenders in our criminal justice system. Because what we know is when those individuals, the nonviolent drug offenders, are getting sent to prison, very few are receiving any services. Another thing that many states have started to do is to entertain the judicial safety valve. So in other states, Georgia, for example, where there have been mandatory minimums, what they have done is allowed judicial discretion back into the equation. So even if there is a mandatory minimum, a judge can circumvent that mandatory minimum in certain cases, typically around nonviolent drug offenders. And then the last point at which you can intervene in that criminal justice continuum is at reentry. And really, what can we do to reduce recidivism? So once someone has served their sentence, what can we do to make certain that they don't reoffend? A lot of research is coming out around the benefits of post-release supervision. Having supervision in place to help that individual stay on track, if you will, once they leave the criminal justice system. But again, with supervision, you need those supervising officers have to have access to resources to help them in other areas. A lot of research around employment and recidivism and the links between those individuals who ultimately get back involved in the criminal justice system are more often than not unemployed. So what can we do to help individuals exiting the criminal justice system obtain employment? So we're looking at licensed occupations, expunging records, help with driver's license, and then finally fines and fees. Oftentimes these individuals leave the criminal justice system and they have many, many fines and fees, you know, upwards thousands of dollars, and that's just one more barrier that they face when they are trying to get strong footing after exiting the criminal justice system. So that is an overview of female offenders and some policy options that would impact that system. I'm going to turn it over to Judge Harris, who's going to broaden the discussion and really focus on kind of what he saw on the bench, and then we can just jump in with questions at any point. Okay.
Well, first, Judge, I want to give Amy a hand. Good afternoon, and my name is Jesse Harris. As indicated, I've been a lawyer about 35 years, and I was a judge for about 28, 29 years. I served as a judge, just a little background on me, 1 year as a municipal court judge many, many years ago, perhaps before any of you were born, and I served as an assistant district attorney for about 5 years. I served as an assistant city prosecutor for about a year, And I probably should have done it in sequence. First, an assistant city prosecutor for a year, then assistant district attorney for a year, then a municipal judge for a year, and then a what's called a special court judge for about 7 years. And then the rest of that time, I served as what's called a district court judge. Now, most of the time as a district court judge, in fact, I should say the lion's share of the time, I was a judge in criminal courts. And so I have to tell you, Amy, that I am one of the bad guys. I'm a person who is responsible for incarcerating so many people. Now, over a period of time, clearly I started to see that incarceration alone is not the answer, not even close to being the answer. And actually, Amy was right when she said that Oklahoma incarcerates more women than any other state in the country. And I'll go one step further. America incarcerates more people than any other country in the world. So Oklahoma incarcerates more women than any other place in the entire world. And there's something about that that, quite frankly, is just wrong. Now, as Amy has indicated, and I can certainly tell you from my experiences, many of the women who are incarcerated, they are, for the most part, incarcerated because of their boyfriends and other family members, people who use and sell drugs, and they, for reasons that I can't even begin to explain to you, women take responsibility for these guys. More often than not, I guess their records are less severe than the records of their boyfriends or husbands or other relatives, so they think, well, you know what, I can take this responsibility for you. And unfortunately, it winds up being a nightmare for women. In fact, I can, but there are other reasons why women are incarcerated. As a matter of fact, the very first woman I ever sent to prison, her name was, her first name was Roshana. I don't want you guys going looking up her case. Her nickname, in fact, she was a prostitute. Back in those days, 11th Street was a place where prostitutes regularly frequented for their business. In fact, this young lady's nickname on the street, as they say, was Head. And because she had a large head, that's the reason why she had the nickname. All right. Now, Roshana, and this story is a nightmare. Roshana, when she was, I want to say, 11 and 12 years of age, she was molested by her biological father. Her mother divorced that fellow. When she was about 14 or 15, she was molested by her stepfather. Her mother divorced that fellow. And by the time she was 17 or 18, she was a prostitute. And as you might well imagine, she was using cocaine for purposes, in my opinion, of self-medication. Now, there probably are some people in this world who could survive a situation like that, but I can guarantee you most of us wouldn't. When the men in your life who you should trust without reservation betray that trust, and particularly when you are a young person, when you're still forming your opinions about the world, is absolutely overwhelming. And in fact, this young woman started to define herself as a sex object, because that's all she knew. And what you grow up with is your norm. There's some people who, you know, grow up with very educated parents, and reading is part of the family activities, and that's their norm. There are other people who grow up with people using drugs in their presence, and that becomes their norm, because that's all they know. So I just use that one woman as an example of, as I said before, oftentimes women go to prison because of the people that they associate with, namely their husbands or boyfriends or other family members. But as she indicated, there are other reasons, and not the least of which are mental health reasons. And I believe that this young lady, Roshana, was suffering from what I would call a mental or emotional health problem. And as a matter of fact, Miss Amy was right when she said oftentimes people are given one chance and then they're sent to prison. This young lady, because I was a new judge and I was horrified by her story, I gave her numerous chances, but She continued to use drugs, and I eventually had to send her to prison. Back then, there was mental health treatment available, and you can't force someone to go. All you can do is order them to go, and if they choose not to, there's nothing that you can do about that. And this woman was in such horrific circumstances that, quite frankly, she probably needed to be put in a place in a hospital. But unfortunately, many, many years before I took the bench, there was a lawsuit against the state of Oklahoma and against other states for placing people in hospitals for indefinite periods of time, and there were lots of abuses, financial abuses, sexual abuses, physical abuses. So it's very, very difficult now to place someone in a hospital for treatment for mental or emotional issues for any lengthy period of time. And I understand why that's the case, but unfortunately there are many people who fall in the cracks and their lives become nightmares. and as I said, I, during my career, was part of the problem of incarcerating people, because you have so many cases and there's so little time, and you're given such a narrow view of someone's life. It's like a photograph as opposed to a moving picture. If you had a moving picture of someone's life, then you understand how they got to where they got to. You have a photograph of someone's life, then you just see them at that moment. And because there's so many cases, and I'll say this too, even though we have at least two lawyers in the room, perhaps the other lawyers. And I saw one young lawyer named Eric Harris, who just graduated from OU's law school. Any other lawyers in the room? Okay. Oh, good. Oh, one other lawyer. And what's your name, by the way?
Jamal.
Okay, very nice to meet you. How long have you been practicing? Okay, well, congratulations. Well, I am not practicing law, by the way. I'm totally retired as of May 30th. But another reason, quite honestly, why people go to prison is the wide variety of talent of the lawyers. There are many lawyers who have never tried a case, do not want to try a case, and plead their clients regularly. And the prosecutors know this. So they know they can recommend any kind of sentence that they want because this lawyer is not going to trial. There are lawyers who could go to trial, but they have so many cases that it's like an assembly line. So they plead their clients. In fact, there's one lawyer whose name I won't mention. He actually charges about $100 to represent someone on a criminal charge. Now, if my lawyer charged me $100, I would say to that guy, I might as well just throw that money on the street because that's money wasted. Because you're not going to do anything for me. $100? I mean, it's just ridiculous. But there are so many lawyers, and people really don't know, unless they've had an experience in the criminal justice system, as to which lawyers they should probably use, or know someone who's had some experience, or know a lawyer, or know someone who knows about lawyers. It's just sort of a random selection of lawyers. They open up the phone book, and they see a lawyer whose name is similar to theirs, Smith, Jones, Brown. They say, I'm going with that guy. Or someone else that they know who's had some problems in the past tells them, go with that person, that man, that woman, and that lawyer is totally unprepared to represent them. In fact, I can honestly tell you, it's a nightmare. In fact, even in trying cases with lawyers who are either unprepared, incompetent, or don't care, just the selection of the jury process is a nightmare because they don't know what questions to ask, and you need to have people who will view your case, your client's case, hopefully in the same perspective that you have. And if you have someone who is unable to select people who are at least open-minded to your particular fact circumstance, you've lost before the trial started. So as a result of which, and I'm not bragging, I'm just saying this is what I did when I was a criminal judge, as a result of which I didn't rely upon the lawyers to do the jury selection process. I did it myself, because that way I knew that at least we would have a level playing field in terms of the jurors who were making decisions about people's lives. I can remember, and sometimes it was very, very difficult not to object for a lawyer. I remember one situation where it was such an objectionable question by the prosecutor, I just looked over at the lawyer and ask him in front of the jurors, do you have an objection? He looked at me like, well, I don't know. I just don't know. So I asked the lawyers to approach the bench. And so I wouldn't embarrass this lawyer in front of the jurors. And I asked him, I said, and it was a male lawyer, by the way. And I asked him, I said, are you sure you don't have an objection? I want you to think about this a moment. And he said, well, Judge, I think, I said, objection sustained. And then, oh, it gets even worse. And I did not hear this. My court reporter heard this guy, and I'm not going to tell you his name. He goes back to his table, and he tells his client, unbeknownst to me, he said to his client, according to my court reporter, man, Judge Harris fell asleep on the wheel at that one. So in fact, the same fellow, he was trying a case in another courtroom, and just so happened I had a friend who was the foreperson of the jury, a woman I knew, in fact, a pharmacist I knew. And during the break, she said, hey, I'm not supposed to talk about this case, but this guy is terrible. So his client was found not guilty because the lawyer was terrible. Now, I don't think that happens very, 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 very often. It just happens that recently there was a law professor from Ohio State named Michelle Alexander. And perhaps some of you may, she was in Tulsa not long ago and gave a talk. And I don't know, perhaps Mr. DeMario Solomon Simmons had a chance to meet her. I didn't. I was in trial. But I happened to see her on the Bill Maher show, of all things. And she did this very short but incredible interview. So I immediately went out and I bought her book, which is called The New Jim Crow. I don't know if any of you have read the book, but it's absolutely fascinating. Now, I'm sure you know what Jim Crow is. That's segregation, or in Africa, apartheid. And the new Jim Crow doesn't necessarily relate to race, although race is a major part of it. In fact, the women who are incarcerated, at least in my opinion, are victims of the Jim Crow system. Not just African Americans, not just Caucasian Americans, not just Native Americans, but in my opinion, poor people are victims of the new Jim Crow. And as Amy, I believe she said, most of these women face severe economic challenges. And just like anything else, the more money you have, the better your result is. Now, I am not saying that the current criminal justice system is a prejudicial system. All right, I'm not saying that at all. But I am saying that people bring their values to the courtroom. And no matter who you are or how you've been trained, you bring your value system with you. Even if you want to ignore it, you bring it with you. I give an example. I was once questioning a jury panel about the police officers who testify. And I asked this particular woman, I said, can you judge the testimony of a police officer in the very same way as any other witness? Her answer was no. I said, why? She said, because they're paid to protect us. So right away, any woman or man or person, for that matter, who's accused of a crime is placed in a disadvantageous situation because their witnesses are not going to be valued as highly as the police officers who testify. Now, am I against the police? Absolutely not. There are many, many officers who toil in obscurity, who are honest, wonderful people who are committed to justice. But just like any other profession, whether it's lawyers, accountants, janitors, there are officers who do not belong in the force. And unfortunately, they have a powerful impact on the lives of other people, and in Oklahoma, particularly women, forever. And not only that, as I said, I was part of the problem too, because as a young prosecutor, I thought every single thing I read in the police report was true, and it's not. Everyone, I don't care who they are, when they take the witness stand, They tell a story from their own perspective, which is not necessarily the same as what happened. The police officers do. The person who's the alleged victim does. The person who's accused of a crime does. I'd even go further and say, even the jurors shade the truth, because if they don't want to serve, they'll say things that they know will automatically get them thrown off a jury. If they do want to serve, they won't tell you the whole story about themselves to get on a jury. So no one tells, sadly, the complete truth. I know this is disturbing to you, but it's true. And only that, I'll go one step further, which I probably shouldn't, but I'm retired now, so I'll tell you. And that is, whether you're innocent doesn't matter. In the courtroom, it doesn't matter at all. I'm sorry to tell you that. It has nothing to do with criminal justice. The thing that's important is what they can prove. That's the thing that's important. If I can tell you one more little funny story, I was trying to shooting with intent to kill case one day, and one of the witnesses identified this fellow who shot at him. Unfortunately, this witness was later killed by someone else, but he was alive then, so he identified this guy. So I noticed that the person accused of a crime, he immediately leaned over and started whispering to his lawyer. His lawyer got up and just asked us a couple of questions, which I thought was unusual since his client was identified as a shooter, and they sat down. Well, as it happens, this particular fellow was found not guilty of the crime. So his lawyer came back to my office after the trial was over, and he said to me, Judge, I know you were concerned about my not asking very many questions of the witness who identified my client. I said, yeah, actually, I thought it was unusual. I won't tell you this lawyer's name. He's a friend of mine. And he said, well, when the guy identified my client leaned over to me, and he said, he's lying. He can't identify me. I had on a ski mask. So he didn't say he was not guilty. He said, I had on a ski mask. That guy can't say. So I tell you that story to say, really all that matters in the courtroom is what can be proven. And I probably disappointed many of you, surprised others, and confirmed the thoughts of some other people in this room. Now, getting back to the new Jim Crow, which I find to be just a fascinating book, and it has something to do with policy. Back when the war on drugs was started, everyone, even minorities, and particularly African-American people, were gung-ho for this war on drugs. And unfortunately, there's something about the sale, the distribution of crack cocaine that involves much more violence, for reasons I can't even begin to tell you, than the sale, the distribution of powdered cocaine. So with the support of many, many people across different kinds of communities, African-American, Native American, Asian American, Caucasian American, everyone wanted to have severe penalties for crack cocaine. And as a result of which, many more minorities and poor people have been incarcerated because of that. Now, it seems as of late that the new U.S. Attorney for the United States, Eric Holder, has realized, along with other people, that there should not be a disparity in sentencing for crack cocaine. And so now, at least in the federal courts, the sentencing has become more uniform. And speaking of the federal courts, just to give you a little glimpse of how poor people are treated differently, in today's paper, I read about a woman, a high-profile lady who was convicted of, you guys may know who I'm talking about, I won't say her name, she was convicted of embezzling, really, stealing, $100,000. By using some public facilities. That's as far as I'm going to go on it. And if you read today's paper, you'll know what I'm talking about. And this woman received, I want to say, somewhere between 7 and 8 months in federal custody, and now she has 8 months of in-home probation. Now, on the other side of the coin, there's a young fellow in state court who probably took less than $1,000 from some people. I won't say his name. And this young fellow got 35 years. So that's the inequity in our system. Now, how does that happen? Because state court, for which I'm also guilty of making sentences, state court, there are no sentencing guidelines. And there should be, because that makes the sentences more equitable. At one point in time, I want to say probably 7, 8, maybe 10 years ago, there was a great push to have sentencing guidelines for state court. Because without them, it's a nightmare. Because judges have such tremendous discretion. And I think Amy kind of touched on it. For many crimes, not all of them, but for many crimes, if you have one felony conviction, you could face a minimum of 10 years in a state penitentiary, no maximum penalty. For many crimes, not all of them, if you have two felony convictions, you face a minimum of 20 years in a state penitentiary, up to forever. Now, fortunately, forever now has been determined to be a life sentence, so we're talking about maybe 45, 46 years. Although, for many of those sentences, they have this other aspect of them, which is called the 85% rule, which means you have to serve 85% of your time before you can even be considered for parole. And there are other drug charges, for example, that if you have two or more drug convictions, if you're charged with another drug case, you could face life without parole. Now, not long ago, in fact, there was a Native American woman, and Amy Santee may remember this, who had a very small amount of marijuana and in a rural county and got a very lengthy sentence. I can't remember how many years it was.
30 years.
30. Which makes absolutely no sense. It was less than an ounce of marijuana. It makes no sense. But judges in state court have wide discretion. And so one of the policy initiatives that I think that the general public should pursue, or at least advocate, in my judgment, is some sort of uniform sentencing policy for state court judges. Now, will that happen? I got to be honest with you, probably not, because of the composition of the state legislature of the state of Oklahoma. I won't tell you what that composition is. Hopefully you already know. And it sounds good to say we're tough on crime. It doesn't sound good to say we're soft on crime. And as a matter of fact, not too long ago, there was some push to have, for example, different categories of sex offenders, because you can be designated a sex offender for urinating outside, just like you're a sex offender for molesting small children. And it's a huge category. And not only that, but you can't live certain places if you're a sex offender. And no one wants to hire you if you're a sex offender. And all these things contribute to men and women going back to prison. Now, I would suggest as a policy change that for those crimes that are nonviolent, for those crimes that involve the use of small amounts of drugs, I would advocate that those records should be destroyed. Because if you go and apply for a job and someone finds out that you have a felony conviction, the chances are that you aren't getting that job. Now, there are exceptions to every rule. And then once you do not get that job, then that's going to affect where you can live, because you can't afford to live anywhere. That's going to affect whether or not you can get married. No one wants to marry someone who's not working, doesn't have a place to live. That affects, if you have children, how you can take care of your children. And so we create this environment of people growing up in very difficult socioeconomic circumstances. And in fact, no one's going to go without food, and it causes people to engage in criminal behavior. Now, I find it interesting in this book, The New Jim Crow. How many of you have read this book, by the way? Oh, great. Well, one of the things I thought was absolutely fascinating is that, and it sounds pretty crazy, but a lot of people being incarcerated has been caused by the change in the kind of economy we have, from about a change from an industrial economy to now a service-oriented economy with very small wages and high technology economy. So that means that people who do not have an education beyond high school, who years ago could go to work at a plant and make a decent living, $30,000. In fact, down in Texas, when oil was booming, my goodness, you can earn $40,000 in the 1980s with just a high school education. So once our economy changed from an industrial economy, that is to say, a manufacturing economy, those people who did not have post-high school education or skills, they just left out. And those are just not black people. They're just not white people. They're just not Native American people. They're just not Asian people. They're all people. They're poor people. So, and then we changed over to this high technology service industry, and it left a whole lot of people out of the loop. Now, the law professor in his book, she suggests that rather than having a war on drugs, we should have had a war on poverty. And in fact, Jesse Jackson says, I don't agree with much of what Jesse Jackson says, even though I have the same name as him, I don't agree with much he says, but he did say something many, many years ago. He said, why spend millions on the back end, that is on prisons, when you can instead spend those millions on the front end and these people will avoid prison? And so it's just not the fact that women are criminal, men are criminal, some people are just criminal people. Because the change in our society, people who are left out are left in dire circumstances in which they have to survive. And unfortunately, the criminal economy, I'll call it, for many people, is their only source of income. Is it right? Absolutely not. But do they have other choices? Absolutely not. And just like Amy was saying, we really need to train people. We need to readjust aspirations, I'll call it. In fact, many years ago, and I don't know if this program is still going on in the prison system, there was a course simply called Thinking for a Change. And it was a remarkable course because it suggested to people, hey, you know what, you need to make decisions about things rather than just acting. Many crimes, quite honestly, are simply crimes of opportunity. They aren't thought through. People see an opportunity and they take it. So by severely punishing people, in most instances, that doesn't deter anyone. Because most of the criminals are not like what you'd call people who are real planners. They're just people who do things. In fact, I remember a judge telling a guy one time, I won't mention this judge's name, he said, you know what? Before you make any other decisions, you probably need to count to 10 just to get them to slow down a little bit. I don't know, is this what you, oh, and one other thing, too, and I talked to Amy about this by way of the telephone before we got here. One of the things that really bothers me, for which there really needs to be a policy change, has to do with these probation fees. They are incredible. You know, for some reason, and the legislature thinks that any time we need more money, rather than raising taxes, because no one wants to raise taxes now. In fact, we're reducing taxes for reasons that I also don't understand. But rather than raising taxes on the good, hardworking citizens of the state of Oklahoma, what we'll do is just add more fees to those people who accuse the crimes. And so what you have is the criminal justice system riding on the backs of poor people who, if they could afford to pay those fees, they wouldn't be in the criminal justice system in the first place. And it's gotten even worse. Now, oh, man, and as a matter of fact, in some of those fees, I have to tell you, some of those fees assessed by judges, a small portion of them, goes to the salary of judges. Now, even worse, now, the district attorneys can assess fees. And they could also supervise probation. Now, just think about this. The person who prosecutes you, that's the person who is supervising your probation. The person who prosecutes you, that's the person you have to pay fees to so that they can supervise your probation. And in some instances, and I think this is a recent case which Amy actually told me about, I didn't know, a person accused of a crime, he can be assessed a fee by his probation officer and also by the assistant DA who's handling his case. Double fees. Now, why in the world would you assess a double fee against someone who steals a $100, well, I should say now, a $500 worth of clothing from a grocery, from a department store? And as you well know, $500 is not a whole lot of clothes. I mean, maybe in these days and times, maybe three or four or five pairs of jeans. So why would you do that to poor people? And what it does, it locks people into the criminal justice system. It guarantees that that person is going to come back. And one other thing, which I mentioned to Mr. DeMario Solomon Simmons, after being on the bench a while, I guess I've probably gone way past my time. After being on the bench a while, I realized that when you sentence someone, you're just not sentencing that person. That person represents about 25 people. That person represents the citizen who's convicted of a crime, his or her children, his or her siblings, his or her parents, sometimes grandparents, his or her employer, and his or her neighborhood. Because once that person is taken out of the neighborhood and he or she can't pay the rent, then that's another empty house or mortgage, as the case might be. So, and it took me a while to realize that because it's an overwhelming responsibility when you see someone and you can affect their lives forever. And there's so many cases, and I'm sorry to say this, that you forget them. And so a decision that I make about someone's, that I made actually about someone's life 2 years ago, I don't remember that. But that decision is going to affect them for the rest of their natural lives. And that's why I tell people now that I'm retired, I left my hair on the bench because it was so stressful. I just ran right out from under my hair. So, but being very seriously, I mean, it's an awesome responsibility. And finally, I'll say, and I'm not bad-mouthing any judges, but finally I'll say that you have to have responsible people in the position of a judge, in the position of a prosecutor, in the position of a defense attorney, in the position of a probation officer. And just like anything else, there are people who are great at their jobs, and there are people who are not so great. And so, unfortunately, that's another reason, in my opinion, for the uneven sentences that are imposed upon people, women, men, but particularly poor people. And one further thing I'll say, that unfortunately, there are still people in this day and age who have, Ms. Santee wouldn't say this, but I'll say it, who have very unusual ideas about women, and as a result of which, that's factored into their decision-making process as to sentencing. And one other thing, that it's amazing how much the manner in which a person presents themselves to a judge affects how the judge views them, and ultimately, to some extent, not large, but ultimately, their sentence. Someone shows up in a coat and tie, they're serious. Someone shows up with their pants sagging, they're viewed as not so serious, and they're not taking it seriously. But anyway, I probably have a million stories for you guys, given the length of time that I did the work. And this work that I, quite frankly, I enjoyed, and if I had it to do all over again, I would still do it. although I've learned a tremendous amount just from reading this book by this law professor, I never thought that the Jim Crow system was anything like the mass incarceration that's going on now. Never even crossed my mind until I saw this woman on the Bill Maher show one day. And when I say new Jim Crow, perhaps a little different from her, I don't mean just black people. I mean poor people, really. People were surprised when O.J. Simpson was acquitted. I wasn't, because not only was he not poor, but he was a celebrity. And they get a different kind of justice from the rest of us, sometimes more severe, sometimes less severe. It just depends upon the circumstances and the charges. Well, I hope I haven't bored you to death. I know that we're over here at 3 o'clock. You guys have any questions for Ms. Santee, who had the wonderful charts, which I learned something from, or from me? And I'll hand her the microphone. I'll start with you. I saw your hand first. Yes, sir. Tell me your name. I'll answer that question this way. Not long ago, our governor had the opportunity to provide insurance for poor people, and she passed on it. And that would have been millions of dollars that would come to the state of Oklahoma. And other states are receiving these millions of dollars. But I believe, in part, her rationale was, it will cost us some money down the road. So we turn down millions of dollars now. So my response to your question is, if someone would turn down millions of dollars to ensure the health of poor people, do you actually think there's going to be a change anytime soon? And that may be not what you wanted to hear, but that's my answer to your question. And not only that, but I'm not against anyone. I'm not against any Republicans, any Democrats. I'm not against anyone. Everyone has a right to their personal philosophy, whatever it might be. Given that Oklahoma is an extraordinarily red state, quite honestly, unless there's some sort of extraordinary change that I don't see, I just don't see that happening. I really don't. Because you know what? There can be enough gated communities to protect everybody. Something has to change, and I hope that it changes before things go way past anything I've anticipated. Yes, ma'am.
I think what it's going to take to make change at the Capitol is for legislators to fully understand that it is the intent of the folks who are electing them that we take a look at the criminal justice system. Because what you're seeing nationally is that the most conservative states are attacking this issue, but not for reasons that we might think. They're attacking it solely on the fiscal cost of incarceration. And so Republicans can embrace that what we know that we're doing is not fiscally responsible. We're spending money on nonviolent offenders who could be served in the community for much less. And so I think that Oklahoma is actually slow to jump on that, though several years ago we did have a Republican champion, House Speaker Chris Steele, and he was able to at least get the legislature to begin thinking about it and recognizing we can't keep doing what we're doing. Our corrections budget alone is close to $500 million, and it has really terrible outcomes. People are going back. Families are being destroyed. The second generation is coming into the system. And so I think that we are getting closer to having an objective conversation about the issue. So whether you are approaching it because I think what we're doing is wrong, because if you look at the individual and all of their circumstances and the fact that they never received services from the time they were young until they contacted that criminal justice system, and then they were quickly pulled in, told not to come back, still didn't receive services, came back, cycle, expensive, go into prison, they're spit back out. I mean, we can't keep doing that. Too many lives, to the judge's point, too many lives are impacted in devastating ways when we do this. So whether we're approaching it because it is the wrong thing to do and it's not working, or we're approaching it because it's expensive and it's not working. Whatever reason we approach it, I think both sides of the fence can agree that change needs to happen. So I'm hopeful. I don't know if I can keep doing what I'm doing if I believe it'll never happen.
Well, Amy is much more optimistic than I am. When I see tax cuts in this state and social services already severely underfunded, I don't understand how positive change can occur. When I see bills in the state legislature which advocate the legislators appointing judges, that frightens me also. So, as I said, she's much more optimistic than I am, and I certainly hope that her optimistic view is the correct one. And perhaps I'm just jaded because I've been in the trenches and I've seen just nightmares. Okay, you had a question. I'm sorry.
Yeah, my question's about...
And first, tell me your name, please.
My name's Lydia Anderson, and I'm an OU law student. I have 1 year left, so I guess I'm almost an attorney. I have a question about expert witnesses. So with the whole problem of the Jim Crow laws on impoverished people, and conversely, these very affluent people are able to pay, you know, so much money to get these expert witnesses to come in and basically completely get them off. Of like, there was a Texas case where they made up a defense of affluency, literally, from a psychologist for a kid who had ran over another person while drunk. And there's other cases where they're bringing in experts on abusive head trauma and ruling out shaken baby syndrome in cases that are clearly child murder. How can we combat that as, like, a defense attorney? Like, what's a good way to counteract money?
Okay, just quickly, I'll say this based on my own experience. In fact, there was a case in Tulsa not too long ago where the actual trial judge himself reversed the verdict. I think it was a life sentence on this young man because he had an IQ of 65. And I don't know if you guys read about that or not. He had an IQ of 65. And his lawyer, who knew this, who later ran for judge, didn't raise that issue in front of the jury. And this young man absolutely positively needed an expert witness. Also, there's a certain tension, I'll call it, between people who cannot afford expert witnesses making those requests of the court, because the court will pay for an expert witness. But the tension is, when is one really needed and when is someone just trying to overwhelm the jury with information? And the court fund is a limited amount of money, and the judges have to make a determination how those funds can be best utilized for all the people who need them. And that's a very difficult process because, again, you have people asking for expert witnesses who really don't need them, and you have other people who should ask but don't. And, again, a lot of it has to do, in my opinion, with the uneven talent of lawyers.
What?
I'd say probably 2% or less, because there are thousands of cases. There's no way in heck everyone can get a trial. And as a matter of fact, for poor people, again, if you're sitting in jail for a year and a half, and prosecutor tells you, I'm going to give you a suspended sentence, who's going to turn that down? Who's going to say, oh, no, I don't want that. I want to stay in jail a little longer so I can go to trial and face time in the penitentiary. But there's a trap of taking a sentence because you sat in jail for 90 days, 6 months, however long it was, because once again, if you have a felony conviction when you get out of jail, in many instances, you face a mandatory minimum penalty. Could be 5 years if it's a drug case, could be 10 years if it's a different kind of case. There's no way everyone can go to trial. And many times, and I'm not bad-mouthing the prosecutors. They're just doing their job. They figure, hey, this is a weak case. If I can get a conviction, I'm going to get it. And maybe this way we'll have some impact. Hopefully, they're thinking in their mind, some positive impact on the community. But when you're poor, you have no resources, you've been sitting in jail, someone gives you a chance at freedom, even though you may very well be innocent, it's just been my observations that more often than not, people jump right on that. All right, yes, ma'am. And tell me your name, please.
Hi, my name is Allison Marota, and one of the things I want to say is obviously we care about the criminal justice, and that's why we're in this class right now. But in your perspective, to keep people from going in down that pathway, what can we do in just our communities to help?
We need to, as citizens, encourage our city administration to try to secure jobs coming into the city of Tulsa, to make Tulsa a more attractive place for businesses. That might involve giving them tax breaks. I know people say, hey, why should they get a tax break? Well, they get a tax break because if they hire people, that's more taxes. And it gives people who work, in my opinion, rarely commit crimes because they're working. They're taking care of their families. And if we can also attempt to re-educate people so we can make them marketable so they can find jobs, I think that helps tremendously also. People often say, well, you know, these people are just poor. We don't care about them. Well, they're poor because they have no opportunities. And I'm not just saying that it has to do with race. As I mentioned before, it has a lot to do with the changing economy. And so we have to train people to participate in the kind of economy we have now and hopefully we'll have in the future. And in my view, jobs and education are the two keys, and also treatment for people who actually have illnesses.
Yeah, and I think he's absolutely correct. In our work at Women in Recovery, it is an alternative to incarceration program for women. We spend a significant amount of time going to employers who have HR policies preventing people with criminal records and talking to them about hiring just one woman. Just try it. So just to emphasize his point, jobs are critical. So to the extent that you're in the community and you're working at if you own your own company or you work for other employers, I think it is important not to discard someone's application just because they have said they have a criminal history. If you're working in the criminal justice system, if you are a defense attorney, I think it is critical that you not only understand the significance of that first plea that you are advising your client to, but you also consider the collateral consequences that will accompany that plea, whether it be around their losing their driver's license or they're losing, they're a teacher and they can no longer, or they work in an early childhood environment, they can no longer work there. I think to the judge's point earlier, oftentimes We I think attorneys will take pleas because they think that's a great deal. My client was going to prison. I got her deferred. And then that's accelerated to a suspended. And then it's an apt to revoke. And there are all sorts of collateral consequences. She might then lose her housing. She might lose her job. And so I think kind of as you practice law, you really have to understand the full collateral consequences of the decisions and the pleas that you're advising your clients to take. I think just as individual communities, and I think OK Policy has done a phenomenal job continually raising the issue, and the papers are listening. I mean, it has not been very long that Tulsa World and the Oklahoman they've kind of embraced criminal justice reform, and that is new. But that is because people, not the typical people, but people in the community are saying, we've got to stop. This is out of control. If you're in an education system, a lot of children are marked as bad kids. That kid's bad. That kid acts out. That kid is, not engaged in education. He's a troublemaker. She's a troublemaker. And then you find out that kid's mom just got sent to prison. That child has now been placed in, you know, in a home that he or she has never been in. And so the behaviors that the educators are seeing might look like they're just acting out or not paying attention or messing with my classroom. But in reality, that kid is suffering a significant trauma that is going unrecognized. And so I think that's a really important piece that we haven't touched on. When you're thinking of criminal justice policy, and particularly when you are looking at the female criminal justice system, you have to consider both generations, the mom and her children. And so what can we do as a community, whether it be expanding after-school care, expanding access to youth development clubs, making sure that caregiver has food to put on that child's plate. All of those services need to be in place for those children, too, to provide a safety net for them as well.
One more thing I want to say. I don't know. I can't speak for women, but men, at least the ones I've known in my lifetime, we oftentimes define ourselves by our jobs and the money that we earn. And if you don't have that opportunity to have a job, to give you a sense of pride, a sense of self-respect, then you're going to go and earn money in a way that you probably shouldn't. There were some more hands. I'm sorry. So that young woman, if you tell me your name, please.
Your professional or personal opinion about the approval of the juvenile facility being built here in Tulsa attached to David L. Moss or utilizing property of David L. Moss, what's your thoughts on that?
More space, and there wasn't much thought to whether there were people in the jail who could be safely released from the jail and supervised in the community. I think we tend to jump to let's build more, and then what happens is we fill it, rather than let's look at what we have and see if we can remove it. To your question, so that was just my opinion on the jail more cost effectively. To your question about the juvenile justice system and whether it should be attached to the jail, my personal opinion is no, it shouldn't. But their facilities are in awful condition. So I was very much in support of better facilities and services for those kids, but not, And just to be, you know, full disclosure, juvenile justice isn't an area for which I spend a lot of time. But that is.
I'm going to echo Amy's sentiments. I also think that the juvenile detention center should not be attached to the jail. I'm just happy that there is going to be one built, because there are people who are in closets in the current juvenile center building, and it's a nightmare, and there are people on top of people, and it's just a horrific situation. It's long overdue. I agree it shouldn't be next to the adults, but I'm happy that we're just getting one, period. Okay, I'm sorry. Are we done? We ran over our time. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm going to ask you. Go on. Tell me.
Marty Reed, Tulsa Community College. What are the benefits for a company to hire felons, and how do we change that conversation with them to do that? And also, how can clients with minimum problems get expungements?
You know, I don't know what incentives companies have to hire felons other than hiring a good employee. Perhaps Amy has some information in that regard.
There's federal bonding and a tax credit, and I can send that information to Gene, because there are incentives to employers. When you partner with programs like Women in Recovery, they have additional benefits for employers. They almost serve as an HR department. Around expungement, that is driven by statute, and I believe it's still 10 years.
Well,
is that
actually,
right, or is it five?
Actually, 10 years for a misdemeanor. And actually, there is a statute that there are, like, I think about 10 different reasons, ways, I should say, in which you can get an expungement. And in order to change it, to tailor it, to help more people, is going to require a change in the law, which means it's going to require the assistance of the state legislature to vote to change that law to help other people. And every single employer that I'm aware of, they check records. They check at the city of Tulsa. They check with OSBI, the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, and they check the courthouse records. So even if you are expunged at the courthouse, if you're not expunged, that means getting your record wiped clean, at the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigations, your potential employer is going to know, and it's a nightmare. And that's another reason why you need to have a good lawyer who not only gets it expunged at the courthouse, but also gives notice to the city of Tulsa and to the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation to get it expunged across the board. And sadly, the lazy lawyers do not do that. And that's the end of my story. And you know what? It may sound like I don't like lawyers. I really do like lawyers, by the way. In fact, I'm a lawyer. I enjoy lawyers. But like anything else, there's some great lawyers and not so great lawyers. All right. Thank you. But I'm sorry to take up more time than probably we have.